Leadership is taking people on a journey where there's a vision, guidance, and purpose.
Good leaders lead with the heart as well as the head.
Leadership means doing the right thing for the right reason, no matter how difficult it might be.
You're listening to Leadership Unwrapped, a podcast where you will hear from people who are living leadership every day.
Hi, Niamh. It was really good to talk to Mari. It's really interesting to hear the insights of someone who's so committed to inclusion and to diversity and her work around her directorship of human rights, which is a career of firsts to develop what she's done. And I know that I've benefited from the initiatives that she has championed in the university. And I can't imagine that it was always easy when you're trying to introduce things and resources are tight, but she's been an amazing champion. People like me have benefited from the work that she does. Yeah. Now that she's the director of human rights in the University of Limerick, it's fantastic to see that this work is valued. I don't know how you find chatting to her, but I certainly find she just is completely herself and completely congruent and 100% a pleasure to talk to and so supportive of everyone. I had a great time chatting to her.
Yeah, absolutely. And she's so honest and open. Yeah. You know, like there's no kind of, I don't know, what would you say, like kind of changing things around, or, you know, she was just so, as you say, just so herself. And it was just a breath of fresh air talking to her. It really was. And I suppose for me, because I'm like earlier on in a career, I suppose if I stay in academia or whatever it is I do, that I'm early on in it puts things into perspective of the work and the dedication of everyone who has come before me in making the workplace a better place for the likes of me coming into it. It really put it into perspective, yeah.
I felt that in the conversation. I felt how far we have come, which I felt was really amazing to achieve. So I could hear the tones of that. Also, I think the piece that... that Mari sort of hides her light under a bushel. She's not really out there saying, I have done all this, but we're the first to have the Silver Award for Athena Swan for equality. You know, we're the first to do a lot of what she's done. And she talks about how she shared that with the sector.
Yeah.
She's an inspiring lady.
Absolutely,
she's worth listening
no doubt.
To.
Hello, so I'm over the moon to introduce Dr. Mari Connolly to you today. Mari is a proud Clare woman, and from the two Kerry women here, we say we really won't hold that against her, but we might think about it. But she is the current Director of Human Rights at the University of Limerick. Mari holds a Master's degree in Education from the University of Sheffield and a Doctorate in Business Administration in Higher Ed Management from the University of Bath. Since joining UL in 2006, Mari has held several key roles, including leading the establishment of the Learning and Development Function within the HR division as a recognised critical resource and a centre of excellence in learning and development. And I think all of us that work here certainly have felt the value of that. Mari is seen as a leader in the field on gender equality, both at sectoral and national level. She's passionate about advancing the careers of women in higher education and to achieving gender equality for all across disciplines. In her role as Director of Human Rights, Equality and Diversity and Inclusion, she's committed to driving transformative, meaningful and sustainable change. And I've worked with Mari for several years, so I'm absolutely delighted to bring her insights to all of you today. I hope you'll enjoy the conversation. So Mari, thrilled that you said yes. Thank you very
you,
much.
Trish. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you so much for joining us.
So Mari, we might start you've had lots of experience in your career over the years, and maybe to give an insight into your career journey for people, might let us know how you arrived to this role as Director of Human Rights.
Yeah, a long journey. Been working a long time. I actually started working at 17. Leaving cert at 16. Actually came here at the time for an interview to do business studies in NIHE.
Oh, right. It's a while ago.
You actually had to go to the Plassey House and do your interview. I was quizzed left to right and centre about economics and all of this. And I was offered a place to do the business degree at the time. It's very new. And my mother decided she'd do a little bit of investigation. And the person she spoke to, who I later worked with for a number of years, said, oh, yeah, I've done it. But she was teaching. and I come from a family of teachers.
All right.
And I said, I do not want to teach. So I went up to Galway.
Fair enough. To the two teachers, off you go.
And then I ended up with learning and development all the time. But so I went up to Galway for an open day for a course up there in the RTC at the time. And my mother said, you know, maybe just think about what you want to do for the year. So I went up there. The crack was mighty, even up for the hearing about the course and everything. And so I decided I'd go to Galway. So I headed off at 16 up to Galway and was having a great time up there. And I went for the bank. And so I've always, I suppose, had a always interested in people and working with people. Even as a youngster, I was always with people and looking after my grandmother and doing all sorts. But anyway, I had thought I'd do children's nursing, but that year, which made sense, they brought science in. I hadn't done science, but they want me to go back. And I said, no, I'm out here.
Yeah.
Little did I know, it's been about 10 years studying later.
Yeah.
So went to Galway and I actually got Allied Irish Banks then. So it was very funny. I did an interview in a bedroom in the Sacacor Hotel in Galway. For after doing the test, the IQ test, that and then you had to go for interview. And I thought, oh, I'd love their job. They're just sitting here interviewing everybody. So it kind of went to the back of my head that HR would be nice at some stage, not even knowing what HR was at that time. But I just thought their job was nice. So actually got the bank, went to Dublin. I was posted to Rathgar, as they say. And absolutely loved the bank. I was listening to Giles, one of your podcasts, and he said, absolutely hate banking. I went,
the complete opposite.
And I thought, oh, I actually loved it. I think I loved it for the people side. It was a really, really, really busy bank, huge accounts, you know, handling massive amounts of money. It was a beautiful old branch, like nice buildings. So I liked the building.
Yeah.
And there was 26 in the branch and 23 of us were single. So it was great fun.
Yeah.
And Coleman's Bar was across the way. So we had great
fun. Good.
And so I was in the bank then up and down, was in a romance, I suppose, since I was a teenager. And then we thought we'd get married. Bad choice, but that's a long story. And went looking to get a transfer. And this is where I think my interest from day one came into gender equality. Because I felt I was a fantastic bank official. I used to get massive praise and I said, I need to get a transfer. They can't lose me. I'm brilliant. Little did I know they could care less. But I insisted on meeting with the director at the time and they were laughing at me even getting an appointment to see him. And went up to Bank Centre and I said, I really, really want to stay with the bank and, you know, I want to transfer. And his answer to me was, if the last thing I need down in the Shannon region is another pregnant woman.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. Cheers.
And I said, well, I'm not pregnant and I don't intend getting pregnant. I was 21. And I said, he said, yeah, but you will. But he said, so no. Even if you had the Pope asking for you, you wouldn't get a transfer. So I thought, oh, that's lovely.
Wow.
So then that was kind of breaking news that I was going to leave my good, wonderful job in banking. And it broke my heart, really, because I loved it.
Yeah.
But I got a job with Shannon Development. And so Shannon Development, the regional development agency for the Shannon region, we were the kind of the IDA and the Enterprise Ireland and the board for the Shannon region. Yeah. And it was wonderful, wonderful company, although I had to start all over again. And I was 21, but I thought that was awful.
Yeah.
So I had to start all over again. And so I went into Shannon Development and they had a mini bank kind of there because the Shannon Development owned all the housing in Shannon. Shannon was a new town.
Yeah.
A wonderful new town without a soul, really. But what they'd done with the airport and Brendan O'Regan and the Shannon Free Zone, and it was an amazing story. And we did consultancy all over the world to show what can be done if you develop a region. And so I was there in the cash office. I came from the bank, so I got the cash office. And then I started seeing injustice there because you had all these people trying to pay their rents. Their rents were quite low, but, you know, they didn't have very good work. Yeah. A lot of relocation from the north of Ireland. It was called Mini Belfast at time. And they were trying to get, you know, rehoused, reset up. And at times you had to refuse taking rent. And then I'd have staff coming down collecting hundreds of pounds of cash in expenses. And I just think there's inequity in this. Yeah. So then I decided, you know, I needed really to go and get my degree. Hadn't done it. Felt I was going to end up bringing up my children in time on my own. Mm-hmm. And so I started back coming into UL.
All right.
So very hard. So once I had my youngest daughter, I did a certificate and then I did the long way around it then. It took 4 years of coming in after working full time, getting my parents to collect my children from a babysitter, bring them home, me not getting home till 10 o'clock at night. So it was hard fought to get my qualification, but I desperately wanted to work in HR. And so I did get that opportunity then. And so make a very long story short, I spent a lot of years then in all different roles in HR. And then I got an opportunity to go and troubleshoot and sort out. I was good at sorting out the unions. I could relate to them. And there was huge issues, union issues in Shannon Heritage at the time, which runs Bunratty Castle and all of the castles and King John's and the Folk Park. And there have been awful bad union relations there, so much so that they couldn't even meet, the management and the staff couldn't meet. The mediator had to come in for the meetings.
Breakdown,
So I went down there and we were troubleshooting and turning everything around, and we did, and the whole management structure changed and we changed everything. So I love that. I love taking on jobs, sorting out a mess and then moving on. For me, it's always a new challenge. What's the new challenge?
What's next?
And so I spent 4 years in Bunratty. Absolutely loved it. I used to say I'd meet the geese walking up the Folk Park thing in the morning and everything used to go downhill after that.
Yeah, lovely.
But wonderful people working there who were laid off every winter. And just the most wonderful women, mainly women, that sold our country to the Americans day in, day out, and didn't make a lot of money, but they just did it for the love of the job. So I felt that was my strength, was bringing those people, respecting those people, showing them that they were, making sure that they were paid, they understood where they were getting their salaries from. And we did lots of different projects that far too long to get into here. But and then I got an opportunity to go back to the parent company as HR manager with the group responsibility overall, both the two companies.
Right.
And again, that was a real challenging time because Shannon Development's future was once again on the agenda, and this time it looked like it was really going to happen. There was always a jealousy that Shannon region had Shannon Development when no other region had it. We even had our offices in New York and San Francisco promoting the Shannon region. So the IDA didn't promote the Shannon region, we had that, and they were always looking for it back. So there was awful conflict there. And so it was a really troublesome time. And again, tried to deal with what they were looking for, cutbacks. Our salaries were ridiculous. People never left Shan Development. And so we had a redundancy package. They wanted the most, they wanted the senior people who they really wanted to go. And I was saying, you can't just target those people. If you have a package, it has to be for senior high cost people. But you got to accept the good with the bad. Like you don't want certain people to leave, but you can't just close it off. You can't just keep targeting. And that's what happened. And then that time, this job came up in the university. So the university was somewhere I always thought I'd love to work. I spent, as you hear, I remember my children knew everywhere around here, coming in and out at weekends. I remember my little son at 4 saying to me, "Are you finished with them books yet, Mom?"
Yeah.
I had that too. And so I loved that time. And so I felt, oh, I really like to work there. Nobody told me it would be quite different working here. But it took a big change to come. But I kind of was at the age I said, well, if I don't move now, I probably won't ever move. And then things were going to move. I would either have been with Enterprise Ireland or with Bord Fáilte. And I thought, I want to make the decision myself. So that's when I came to the University of Limerick in 2006.
And then you did a master's when you were here. Was that before?
That was before I came here. And then when I was here, there was a lot of different things happening in HR at the time. And I did the UCD executive coaching.
Oh, very good.
So qualified as an executive coach. And I love the coaching piece. And I was going to go on and do more in that. But I've just felt myself working in academia that I really wanted to have my doctorate.
Yeah.
And so I got the opportunity to what the program in Bath was doing was bringing higher education management into it. And I just felt that extra qualification would really position me well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I, in fairness to the university, which was fantastic, they supported me to do that program.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah.
And the experience was brilliant. So, yeah, I it took a few years, part-time, 5 years.
Yeah.
It's a big undertaking. And it's like having that monkey on your back.
That's constantly?
Yeah. Yeah. But it's well worth it in the end. You forget about the pain when you have it.
Yeah, you do. And you did it on mentoring, which is very close to our hearts. We're very passionate about mentoring and coaching too. So that's something that you feel strongly about too?
Very strongly. So my doctorate thesis was on looking at mentoring from a knowledge perspective. Mm. So what's the knowledge that's shared in mentoring? And what's the value of that knowledge? And for me, it's that tacit knowledge. It's the knowledge that isn't written down anywhere. It's that absolute experience that mentors have that they actually don't even realize they have, that they can pass on. Yeah. And I feel as institutions, we don't value it enough. You know, we don't tap into it enough. We pay consultants to come in to deliver programs to our staff when we actually have all that expertise within our institutions ourselves. So tapping into that knowledge is really, really important to me. And so I had when I came in actually to this role, the equality agenda was separate to HR. But I got very involved in it very quickly.
Yeah.
And there was philanthropy funds for a post at that time, and Nora was in that post. So we worked really well because, again, I had the passion for equality. And so one of the initiatives we set up then was the formal mentoring program.
Yeah.
And I rolled that program out, and we were the first institution to have a formal mentoring program. Initially just for women, and we felt women only wanted female mentors because they wanted people that had combined work and home and had those challenges, especially in academia where you're trying to research and publish as well. But then that all changed. The people goes, and I want the best mentor. It doesn't have to be a woman. Mm-hmm. And then the men felt, well, why are you only doing this for women? We went, actually, why are we?
Yeah.
You know, we know women were totally underrepresented in the academic roles. They were absolutely underrepresented in STEM and totally underrepresented at that stage in 2006. I think we had about 17% of women as professors less. And so we did want to give women that additional support, but we didn't want to not make it available to anybody.
Yeah.
So it really worked very well for a few years, and then it kind of waned off a little bit. Mm. But it's something I'm delighted to see is happening again.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm curious about, because you said that you did the course in executive coaching before you joined the university. So I'm just wondering, because like in the course that we do, we teach them together, mentoring and coaching. I'm curious, like, how did you go into the mentoring space from?
Oh, I actually did the executive coaching when I was here. Because I was looking at, I had gone for a job. I'll talk about, you know, when you get knockbacks, and I had gone for a role that I wasn't successful in. And I had previously been deemed appointable for the role, and I just thought, oh my God, that doesn't say much if, before I came in here, I was deemed appointable. And when I went for the can, I didn't get it. And I think there's something radically wrong here. Mm. And so I felt, I need to do something from a coaching perspective myself to see, is it something in me?
Mm.
And so it's a very intense executive coaching program. I wanted to do something that was absolutely certified because I just think so many uncertified coaches out there and so many people dabbling in it and can do a lot of damage. So I wanted to do something that was very well certified. And I'm trying to think, the UK certification, it came from the UK, but the UCD really got that program. Yeah, they were very clever.
Yeah.
But so the coaching was, I see coaching and mentoring very connected, although I see coaching quite different to mentoring. I think managers coach. I think mentors do a different job.
And
coaching sometimes can be looked on taking a problem and how do we solve this problem, whereas mentoring to me is about your holistic self and giving you that wisdom to combine everything, and you either take it or leave it.
Yeah.
You know, you just take on board what you want. The person sharing their experience, they're not saying this is going to work. They're saying this is what I did and you can learn from that.
Yeah.
And that wisdom is invaluable.
Yeah. And I think I've benefited from some of your work, and I said this to you earlier. So I have been in the mentoring program and in the Springboard program that you've championed as well. And I said to you earlier, it's changed my career completely, which I'm very grateful for. But until you have experienced it, you don't really get the richness of even just the seeds that are planted that you mightn't pick up right now. But in 5 years' time, suddenly that's the slow burn. It makes sense to you.
Yeah.
So that mentoring piece, it's a safe space to just see how other people have done it and to take, as you say, to take the bits that will work for you and to forge a new way for the pieces that don't. So I'm quite impressed with that.
And for mentors to give so openly of their time and share their time. We've just brought that in now, and we're leading preparing for academic advancement program, which we've always in UL, we've led the way in a lot of gender equality initiatives, but we've always shared with the sector what we've done. So I think we've been really open in that.
That's
and
great.
So for this program, we got gender equality enhancement funding
it. Okay.
And we've now put 45 women at senior lecture level, because with looking at our data and the data across the sector, we see that the leaky pipeline for women starts at lecture level, where they're most likely to go and have children and have a break in service.
Mm-hmm.
And UL again has been to the lead in bringing in what we call a research grant for returning academic carers, which gives 6 months protected time when you've had a break.
Yeah.
That's been invaluable to the women who can't talk, really can't talk more positively about it. And the amount of women that have been successful in promotion for having got that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that pipeline is now, we has got less and less, and now we have 39% of women at associate professor level. But what we said was we'd share it with the sector. So we put this program together where we assigned mentors from different institutions.
Yeah.
Whereas the individual could be really open about what they felt were their weaknesses. It's absolutely to prepare. It probably is a little bit more like coaching than it is to prepare a successful portfolio for promotion. And what we've given is that we're going to track the impact of giving them this supportive initiative, how successful, because they have to agree to submit an application for promotion within 2 years doing the program. Otherwise, they won't get on the program. And we also have an assessment to get on the program.
Okay.
So it's been a very interesting support mechanism and intervention that we've led on here.
That sounds brilliant. I mean, it's very outcome focused and scaffolded, which I think is fantastic. I also think having someone outside of your own organisation is a very good thing, because we do enculturate into the way things are done around here. And sometimes there are myths in the organisation that aren't helpful, but that are talked about a good bit and seen as fact. So getting outside perspective is brilliant. I think it's really good.
I always quote one of the women that gave me feedback. She said, I used to think, well, what if I see this mentor across the table at an interview? And she said, and he'll remember that I was a mad bat when I was talking to him.
No, they won't.
No, they'll remember that you were interested enough to put yourself into that space.
Yeah,
they'll be a sponsor, as Kingsley has said. And you know,
exactly.
I think his work is really interesting. We're going to talk to him soon.
Fantastic.
He's talked about that sponsorship, that how people talk about you and how people see your work, because you're putting yourself out there and networking and connecting. It's a good thing.
And that you want help. You know, everybody needs some support and some help. And I think not being afraid to ask for it, that shows courage, and that shows, you know, that you want to get on, you know, rather than sitting hoping things will change. They won't change unless you change.
Yeah, So being able to ask for it, being able to see the block.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, I think... working in an organisation where that's valued and put out there as something that's important helps, and that you've championed that here, helps people to ask for that help or to move forward in that way.
And value it.
Yeah, value it.
And we have to value the mentors then that do it, you know, really, really value. They're very busy.
Yeah.
They are our most senior staff. And we really, really appreciate that they, you know, that they cooperate and gladly do it.
Yeah.
Actually, one mentor said to me, so actually part of my thesis was looking at, well, what do mentors get out of it?
Yeah.
And it's amazing what they do. Yeah. So what senior mentors said to me were, you, when you're at that level and you're not maybe managing a department or you're not head of department or head of school, you feel that you've got your finger off the pulse of what's happening in the institution. Yeah. And by mentoring junior staff, you get a much better sense of, oh, this is what they're doing in that department, these are where there's issues, we should be looking at that, and that they felt they got a lot from us.
Yeah.
So it is a different relational mentoring, we call it, where both parties gain from it.
Yeah. And it brings something back to, you know, as a mentor, and you hear the developments that are happening in other places, you can bring them back into your own work. Exactly. There's a contagion in a good way, I think, which is really important. And it's really important when you are successful, I think. And success is different for different things. I'm not just talking about, you know, being at the top, but that you're willing to give that back, that you're willing to offer that time is really important for the people. I mean, part of the piece around advancement is that when we are successful, that we reach out the hand to help others become successful as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Because so many people pull the ladder up behind them and they don't. And I'm sorry to say that women can be very guilty of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that they don't sponsor young women and give them the opportunity. They're too busy at the top. And it's something that I'm always really, really conscious of.
Mm.
Giving younger people coming up the opportunity, giving them the opportunity to have that exposure.
Yeah.
You know, getting them to stand out there and giving them the courage to do it, I think is so important.
Yeah.
Was it you, Patricia, that was saying recently about that kind of analogy of the ladder, that instead of the ladder, now it should be casting a net? Was that you?
I'd love to say it was, and I'd be thrilled, you know, that I was that brilliant, but unfortunately not. But we were in a conversation together. I can't remember
who said it.
But it was really valuable.
It was like,
you catch more, you bring more together.
Exactly.
Yeah, instead of the one person coming up the ladder, that you can try is bring as many people as you can along, which I thought was another kind of added...
It's wonderful to see that.
Yeah.
And do you see a lot of it in academia?
No, I think we are quite individual by the nature of the work.
Yeah.
So there's a mind shift needed in that, because we think we are competing with each other.
Yeah.
And we're not always competing with each other, but there is that sense that you are. So, and that that conflicts then with that being collaborative and supporting and bringing forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've a long way to go in terms of culture and higher education globally. This isn't
Absolutely.
About our own university here. This is an issue across all of higher education.
Yeah, I've really found, and I know we spoke about before we were recording, just kind of like the differences in generations and things like that. But like, I suppose maybe the competitiveness isn't an issue because I'm so early on in my career. You know, I'm not in a place where like I could be seen to be in competition with someone, if that makes sense. So maybe that's part of it. But maybe it is. Like going in a positive direction, because I really feel that my experiences of people supporting me have been very positive. I've really felt that so far.
That's great to hear.
Yeah. I think when you ask younger women, when we start talking about gender equality and the whole equality role, they go, oh, I don't think there's any inequality. It's only when you get up along in an organization that you suddenly go, all right. Okay.
Yeah, you come up against something.
So who's called every time a child is sick? Who's called every time they'd be the first to have to take the, you know, to leave work an emergency because you're worried and it's in your nature to go and sort it. So it isn't until, I definitely think it isn't really until well into your 30s that you begin to see, okay, now maybe I see what they're talking about.
Yeah. And I think it's also as you progress in the career and you come up against some of the glass ceiling pieces that are still there, or the unconscious biases, or and even the ones that we've internalized ourselves. So even the messaging that as women we feel is appropriate to say, we can be more apologetic, we can be more, you know, just kind of almost apologizing for existing or looking for resources or doing whatever, yeah. because that is the way I think it's changing in the generations that are coming next. But for my generation, that certainly was a huge piece of work that we had to do to change the messages of how you were sending your messages. I mean, I would start my emails, you know, at lecture level, even at senior lecture level, and I'd be saying, sorry for bothering you, but can you? Mm-hmm. And every email would be starting with that, and then a load of thanking at the end because it was uncomfortable to ask for the resources. And my male colleagues weren't doing that. And it took a bit of unpacking to go, why? What is that about? Why am I doing that? If you are abrupt or you are too direct, you're seen as being cold. As a woman, I think you feared being seen as cold or uncaring or not collegiate. So you were trying to navigate that.
It's getting that balance, because women that are tough are then are criticized because they're too like men. It's really women finding their own area, their own kind of space to say, okay, I need to. Like, we see the gender pay gap has actually happened because women just would, this is your salary, a man will go in and negotiate. Now, thankfully, with the framework, that has changed slightly, and that you're not able to negotiate salaries. But that's where the huge anomaly started. Then women working part-time, giving up full-time jobs, when they had children, like all of that gender pay gap, it's going to take years for it to be resolved. In this sector, we're lucky because you get paid on a salary scale.
Yeah.
But it's where's the first point you started on, and how do you catch up? So I think women definitely aren't good for asking for things. Women also find it very difficult to put themselves forward. Mm-hmm. I always think of Susan Jeffers' book. You know, I'm always saying when I do springboard with the women, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway.
Absolutely.
Take the opportunities. If you're absolutely scared, you'll be just glad you did it.
Yeah.
You know, somebody will be there to give you the courage. But don't turn down the opportunity, you know, unless it's totally unworkable.
Yeah.
Take the opportunities. But then women also need, and we were talking about that, Trish, how to say no, because you need to be clever in what you're taking on board.
Yeah.
And it's in women's nature in academia to put the students first. They will always put the students first. They will meet the students. They won't have the same rules about meeting students. And then they get all their time is going into student one-to-one support and into administration and leadership. And then their research falls behind. Whereas men are a lot cleverer, and it's not a men-women thing, but they are a lot cleverer in saying, no, I have to get my research. This my paper is going out. So I think we've got to learn to be a little bit more strategic in what we do and what we say yes to and what we say no to, without taking away from what are my core values. So I think all of us need time out to remember. And that's why I love working with women when we do the springboard. I said, well, what did you want to do when you started out? What are your core values in life? You know, where are you at in relation to that? And it's amazing to watch how they evolve and say, actually, why am I just sitting here taking that? I need to have this conversation. And it's not fearing that conversation. Sometimes it just needs to be said. And deciding, well, I have to change. I can't wait for everything else to change. If I'm staying in this role and absolutely hate it, nothing's going to change. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think it's really good. Or it's things happening at home, you know, toxicity at home.
Mm-hmm.
You bring your whole self to work.
Yeah.
And you're trying to be authentic at work, but you can't be if all this stuff going on.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, that's what leadership's all about.
Yeah.
And I know everyone talks about authenticity and being authentic, but it's really, do you really understand what that is? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not telling everybody about all the challenges in your life, and it's when it's important to connect with somebody that's going through the same maybe challenges and say, well, look, you know, I've been there, I understand that. It's being you, it's not pretending you're something else inside in the workplace and something else at home. Like, you know, we're all about being our holistic self, as we say, you know, and I think good leaders are good at that. Other leaders are not good at that.
Yeah.
You know, they don't connect. They don't have the empathy.
Yeah.
They don't have the connection. To me, that's what good leadership is about.
Yeah. And I think there's something huge in what you're saying about when somebody is experiencing a challenge and it's quite big, and then as a leader or and as a woman leader, that you say, I actually had that too. Mm. And I felt this, and this is what happened for me. And, you know, there was a few ways of going around it. But in that moment, you're saying to the other person doesn't know that you've had those same struggles or challenges or that you've come up against that, unless you are authentically able to say, yeah, not alone there. You know, that there's many of us that have gone before that have been challenged on that
and
one.
And seeing it, Trish, you know, you might see somebody's acting different at work and you just think, what's wrong? It's actually looking and seeing you talk, and your paper brought that back to me about the incivility.
Yeah.
It's calling that out. Mm-hmm. I've experienced that for a long time, and I never really called it out. And when I did, I was told, that you've just got a personality issue. You just don't get on. I'm thinking, I don't have a personality issue with this person, but this behaviour is unacceptable.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as a leader and the manager, you should see it's happening. And then you're beginning to think, is it you? Am I imagining it? But you know you're not.
But I think saying to you that it's a personality issue is the ultimate gaslighting there is, because it's so easy to frame poor behaviour as a personality issue because when you call it, people will, you know, the namer becomes the problem when we do this. But we need to do it and to do it without fear, in gentle ways that can move things forward, but really refute the personality conflict crap that people say, which allows you to individualize the problem to two people as opposed to the systemic embedding of incivility, where it's tolerated that any time a person that you don't like speaks in a meeting, you roll your eyes and you sigh and you send the message to say, oh, not this again, which silences the other person. We pick up that energy from each other all the time.
Yeah, I really think it's wonderful to see it being called out now, because I don't ever have seen it until you mentioned it in the conference. I was thinking, actually, that's what that is, actually. Yeah. There's a name for it.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is. But it's interesting. I mean, you talk about it, the intersectionality of pieces, and we've talked about this earlier. We'll probably mention it again now. But there is an intersectionality piece in a different way, but around this too, because the gate, and I talked about this, the behaviours that are uncivil are gateway behaviours for gender discrimination and gateway behaviours for harassment or for all the other pieces. So, and the more that I use this phrase that my mother-in-law used to say, she used to be teasing us, and she'd say, constant dropping wears a stone. And I know I said this, but constant hearing the same thing wears away at you all the time. So that constant incivility becomes, oh, maybe there is something wrong when I ask the question. Maybe I shouldn't be asking the questions.
Yeah. Are disrespecting what you're bringing to the table.
Yeah.
I think that happens quite a bit, you know, disrespecting the experience people bring from outside.
Yeah.
Just because you haven't been in academia all your life, you know, you don't have the same experience. Yeah. And I always think it's really important to respect what people bring to the table.
Yeah.
And to listen, you know. It may or may not make a difference, but they should have an opportunity to speak.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly. And what I found is that with the students, it's what they value the most, is that if we bring people from practice, they're getting the chance to connect some of the things that we're saying to real life. And then if you can bring people into the workplace that have that, you know, it's the high bar, but we have a job of work to do to be accepting of that, if you know. So that's quite a challenge, I think, for us, you know.
I think it's like complicated, though, and a lot of this takes a lot of courage too, doesn't it? You know, even the authenticity piece, like that takes, that's a journey. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think there's a lot of courage that comes with being able to be your authentic self in your workplace because of all of the various challenges that are there. And there's also a huge intrapersonal piece around it as well. You know, a lot of people, like, I find the more people you talk to, the more you realize that, like, you people that you think are confident in, you know, maybe their work life or their personal life or whatever it is, you know, everyone is questioning themselves a lot of the time. You know, so it's like, I suppose it's just to add that in there, like, it's not something that I think should come easy to people either, you know, this bringing your authentic self, because it's something that's spoken about so much. And it is the high bar. It's, you know, what everyone would be aiming to do. But I think it is a journey. You know, I don't think you're going to get into a position and immediately, you know, you're learning so much and there's so much going on. You know, you're not immediately going to be like, feel like you're the one, the whole person. You know what I mean? I think it's just
Niamh, it takes experience.
Yeah.
It takes the life, the Knox life can send her away to feel, you know what, this is me. This is this is who I am, and this is the way I want to manage. This is the way I want to behave.
Yeah.
And as you say, it takes a long time to I suppose have that confidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think it's something we as women can give to other women, you know, and help women, because I do think women relate very well to women. I think that's why maybe the springboard programs and those that we've run, women feel they can be open and honest with other women. Sometimes they find it harder, especially if it's something personal, when there's a mixed a group in attendance. So I get an awful lot from the women in when they're in the springboards about, you know, opening up, and it's okay to be upset. Like, whereas people are terrified to be upset now. Mm-hmm. I mean, you hear that from managers, oh, golly, don't cry, you know.
Yeah, don't emote, I think was the advice I got when I was taking up the role. Whatever you do, don't emote. I was like, okay. Well, that didn't work, but.
I remember, it isn't going to, though, is it? You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're all emotional human beings.
Yeah, we are. You have to bring your emotions. Your emotions are always with you.
Yeah.
I remember being told if I ever wanted to advance my career, I'd want to give up that all the quality stuff.
Yeah. I had a similar, if I wanted to advance my career, not to research that bullying piece because, you know, did you want to be known as the bullying woman? You know, it's like, no, I really don't. But it was really interesting about what is okay to, and thankfully that's changed.
Yeah,
I think certainly, still talking about incivility in higher education, and still talking about the culture of staff rooms in schools, it's still early days there. People are still quite nervous of that, and we certainly get some reactions to the research when we want to talk about things like toxic leadership, for example.
Okay.
The pushback is very strong. But that to me is a signal that it needs to be done, that there's something that needs to be uncovered.
I suppose school, as you say, the school tea room and that, schools can be quite small, so it becomes quite personal.
Yeah, it does.
So it's almost easier to tackle it in a larger organisation.
Yeah.
So it is harder to do it, but I think that's where the things like team building, honesty in the team building. But people find it hard to give you honest feedback. And I think, again, the good leaders are the ones that can actually give you honest feedback.
Mm-hmm.
Like telling people everything's wonderful is useless.
Yeah.
Telling people you did a great interview, but, like, what are you going to gain from that? Why don't you give proper feedback to say, well, actually, you answered that question dreadfully. You didn't even think to bring that in. And at least you go back away with thinking, actually, I didn't answer that dreadfully. But people, they won't do it. And I think, again, that's where we need to train our leaders. You have to be able to, it's way more value to the people reporting to you to give them that honest feedback.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of saying everything's wonderful and behind their back saying, actually, that person isn't matching up at all or measuring up. So again, they're the traits to me that are so important in leadership.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's huge because the hurt, I mean, people look for feedback and they don't get it. They get more hurt.
Exactly.
They get more hurt. Now, there's timing for feedback.
Yeah. There is a time not to do it when you're really upset and really emotional. But I think the feedback is really important and we don't do enough of it.
Yeah.
We could have a whole debate on the interview processes, like making massive decisions, seeing somebody for an hour.
Oh, that's mad. It's mad. It's madness. Mm. I had an experience recently where it was a series of several.
Mm.
And I was blown away by it. I thought
much
it was
better.
The best thing.
Absolutely.
I had a good sense of what the culture of what you would be buying into would be.
Mm.
And I hope they had a good sense of what I would be and who I would be. And I came away, the whole experience, really energized.
Yeah. We really need to look at it.
Yeah.
And you talk about the intersectionality there, piece there, and that's too for, like, our interviews do not suit people that are neurodiverse. We don't make any effort to have a different process. Candidates that are neurodivergent can be exceptionally bright, but absolutely appalling at interview. Yeah. They just do not excel. And we can't see beyond that.
Yeah.
Because you hear, the fit isn't right, or they're not going to. And you think, it's not about the fit. Can they do the actual job? Yeah. You know, and it's so disheartening.
It is.
So we have a huge piece of work. That's, I suppose, one of the areas now in our broader remit in our office is to look at all of this. We've concentrated a lot in the past over addressing the gender equality issue. I'm delighted that the university is the first university in the sector to achieve a Silver Athenis One Award.
That's fantastic.
And that's not easy you know, it really is. What we had to show was the impact of all the different initiatives that the university invested in. What has been the results and what have been the impact of that, and how we embedded the equality agenda across the institution. And we've still now got to go into the other units. But now we've got to look at, okay, so now we've got all the issues in relation to gender and ethnicity. So what's our data? To me, I'm a real, have to be driven by data. Yeah, so you need the data. What's the data telling us? Our staff and students from ethnic backgrounds are not giving us the feedback. There is a real sense, talking to students that come from very different backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, that you don't complain. They don't trust authority. They really won't tell you what's going on. But yet when we look at our anonymous reporting tool, we know there's issues, and we know there's a lot of issues.
Okay.
So we have to build the trust that you come and tell us what's happening so we can try and resolve it.
Yeah.
And so you've got that. You've got that with disability. You've got that with students coming from socially disadvantaged, socioeconomic disadvantaged areas. And we've got all of the different areas. You've got the whole issue around ageism.
Yeah.
And we're trying to address some of those issues as well. So the EDI agenda in higher education is vast, and it's only growing. Yeah. And we've so much work to do in the space.
That's the tricky part, I think, about EDI as well, is depending on the area that people are passionate about. You know, if one area moves forward a little bit, it doesn't necessarily bring another area with it, or it could have a negative impact on that other area. So I think that's the challenge, because obviously all of the different types of initiatives do need to happen. But like, if there was some way of having a more holistic view of it as well, I think it would be brilliant for moving the whole initiative forward. You know?
And that's the work we're doing now with our human rights and EDI strategies. So we are driving that as a values-led.
Brilliant.
So we're taking what are the values of this institution and how are we going to demonstrate that? And so we're doing a really nice piece of work where when we set up the office here on March 21, we looked at everything that was happening across the university, like you're suggesting, Niamh, and we took and put them into four key pillars.
Right.
So you've got the pillar of gender equality, which we were advancing very well on. But then you've got the whole area of inclusivity, universal design for learning, the whole area of disability and accessibility. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the whole area of the ethnic diversity, race equality. We've got the race equality surveys that's just been done. And that is pointing that staff that declare that they come from an ethnic background are more likely to be on precarious contracts, because a lot of our ethnic staff are in researcher roles, so they come with vast experience from all around the globe, and their contracts are dependent on funding and on research funding. So it is demonstrating that they're more likely to be on a lower salary, more likely to have a precarious contract of employment. So that is a whole area now that we need. We don't have the ethnicity of our staff, so we need the staff now to tell us it's for this reason we want it. We want to ensure that we don't have certain anomalies, even though we know we do.
Yeah.
And we also need the research staff who are predominantly from ethnic backgrounds to tell us what it is like to work here.
Yeah.
And that they work for the university as opposed for the researcher.
For their PI. Yeah, for their PI, yeah.
And then we have, then our other area then is a huge, huge area for higher education is the whole area of sexual violence and sexual harassment.
Yeah.
So that is an area that we're working hugely on now. Mm-hmm. So putting policies in place that cover staff and students, putting supports processes in place for students. We have a student designated contact person panel. We're training our students. And it's really too late. It should be happening in primary school, mm-hmm. like at sixth class.
Yeah.
The whole training on consent, understanding consent, because it's not just for young girls, young boys.
No, for
and,
all.
And being a mother of a son, I always feel for young boys who end up ruining their lives because they didn't fully understand what consent meant.
Yeah.
And that training is crucial to them understanding mm-hmm. that if somebody is incapacitated and something happens, then you can ruin your life.
Yeah.
So we feel very strongly. And when the young men come, I'm always saying to them, this isn't just about the girls.
Yeah, absolutely.
This is about G and how you need to protect yourselves. Mm-hmm. And sometimes young boys, again, being a mother one, can be headless. So you need to, they're not as clever sometimes, and you need to get them to look at them, to check yourself here. So we have a huge, that's another one of our pillars. Yeah. So they're all coming together in under our new strategy that we're doing as a values-led strategy.
That's fantastic to hear,
I think it must be a hard role to hold because you, and we talk about this in leadership, but, and I always use this phrase, people don't know what they don't know, whereas you have the overview. And so sometimes when people are, maybe have ideas or are coming, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, but maybe have ideas or are coming at things, they might not see the bigger implications and they'd be thinking, well, why aren't you just doing this? But you have the bigger piece that you, and you can't always share all of that either. So I would imagine to use Joe Owen's phrase, the political quotient, that piece and the emotional intelligence piece together would be very important in a role like yours, I would imagine.
And it's because you'd love to be able to do it all, but like limited resources, you're trying to do it in a measured way. It's important not to be, I suppose, fanatical about things.
Yeah.
Like something can set something off and you've got to say, okay, we need to think about this. What are we going to do? Rather than just all the time troubleshooting and reacting. So you need to plan ahead. And people do get very emotional about things. Yeah. And you're saying, what are you doing? Where's that policy? And we're going, we are doing it, but we're doing it in a measured way.
Yeah.
We can't do these things overnight. You've got to have consultation, collaboration.
Absolutely.
You've got to make sure that we're doing it right. And so, people can get very impatient with you.
Yeah.
Or they can say, suddenly everything's in this area. And you're going, what else are you going to put in here?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
it's, you know, there's, we're trying to do what we're trying to do. As they say, you can only do what you can do.
Absolutely.
But we're trying to do it and make impact.
Yeah.
Wish we had could do more faster. We've got such a diverse community in our universities now. It's really hard to reach everybody and it's really hard to ensure that everyone has that sense of belonging to a university. That we are looking out. We have to educate ourselves. Like really, Ireland is so far behind in understanding the broader ethnicities, mm-hmm. broader biases that mm-hmm. we have, and we all have them. And it's that education piece is so important.
Yeah, I agree.
Because when does it start to change? When you see little ones in primary school, they don't know the difference of somebody's mm-hmm. colour. They don't see it. So why does it all start festering when you get into secondary school?
Mm-hmm.
So is it in the home, the lack of education in the home of understanding, you know, that whole it's a minefield that
we have to
impact on.
Yeah.
And it's still quite new for us, as you say, you know, in my generation, it's quite new that the changing demographic is quite new in comparison to other countries, I think. So there is a lot of work that we need to do to open up our minds around all of that.
And people make mistakes. And I think it's really important to to know when something is meant as an insult or where people actually genuinely make a mistake yeah. and say, you know, we hear people saying, you know, it's a microaggression to ask somebody where they've come from. Well, learn from it. Never ask this again. You know, we have mm-hmm. black Irish people. You don't need to know where their great-grandfather from. Just keep it going back. You know, you need to stop that. Now, yeah. we know that that's wrong, so don't do it. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to learn from that. But sometimes, as you say, the older generation wouldn't even know. I remember my father used to be dreadful asking, were you there for the war? And we're going, Dad.
Like, yeah.
You know, with time, we're all learning. We're learning what's acceptable. What's not acceptable, but then gets to a stage, well, it's absolutely not acceptable.
Yeah.
So learn. So we've a huge, as educators.
Yes.
We have a massive, massive job to do.
Yeah.
And I think we have a responsibility on us to educate, especially the future teachers of the world that you're educating. They have a huge job. Mm-hmm. And I think making sure that those teachers, those young teachers that are going to be teaching the youngest generation, that they are absolutely go through in-depth training on race equality, on anti-racing, on all of that, on biases, because they may have carried those from their own background, and they need to be.
Yep.
You need to deal with them. And I think if we start there, I think you have in the School of Education a massive role.
Yeah, I agree.
I think sometimes we forget as well, like what's important for students or young people is also important for adults. Like, and I know, do you know, if we were in a perfect world and we had a few generations where like people were educated all these like about all of these things that we're talking about when you're young, obviously those people when they would grow up would bring those values with them. But like things like I was even thinking about it when you were talking about the interviews, Mary. So like when you're saying about, you know, being inclusive of them, I was just thinking about how we're trying to move exams that way for students, so that it's no longer just a written exam. You know, I know we're not doing it perfectly here, but when you think about things like the junior cycle reform and you know, trying to include more continuous assessment and different types of assessment and things, so like, you know, that should be the catering for students' different needs within schools. It's very similar to the catering of people's different needs in an interview setting, for example.
Yeah.
And we're not necessarily transferring that, but that's going back a little step. But what reminded me of it there again was the sense of belonging piece. Like, I went to the World Ed Summit, the World Education Summit was on a little while ago, and I went to a few sessions, and there was a few sessions on belonging. Mm. And how that's one of the biggest challenges that students are facing now, particularly after COVID as well, of course. And obviously that's tied in as well with the equality, inclusion, diversity and those types of things, and the journey that students have to go through in developing their own sense of identity and, you know, feeling belonging within a particular setting. But that's also true for adults in a workplace.
Yeah, absolutely.
Know, and I think sometimes we forget about that a little bit.
Yeah.
And we need to, when we bring new people in, we need to make sure we look after them, that their experience is a positive experience. Mm. And as that, the sense of that they do belong to this department and this department cares for them. Yeah. And that's where the mentoring and the buddies system, we try to get the departments to do that. But they also need to meet people outside of their own little group as well.
So.
Because you find in big institutions like ours, there's an awful silo effect, and people only meet the people in their own areas. And it's really good to reach out, and that's why the networks that we have set up here in UL have been fantastic for that. You know, we have the Apex Network, the Evolve and the Emerge, and and they came from the roots up, you know, junior academic and women setting them up and bringing communities together, particularly after COVID, because the biggest feedback, and we did two surveys while our staff were on working from home, and the isolation that people felt and the frustration where children weren't going out to school, or the frustration where they had special needs children, like some of us never even thought about that they were in the house, they were trying to work. I mean, some staff were working crazy hours, they were working during the night because they couldn't work during the day. So, and students, I feel their student experience for the students that were trying to do their degrees during COVID has been just dismal.
I think we're just unpacking some of those issues now. I think they're coming, they're surfacing now. And certainly for one of the things that we were talking about now, even in our own department, as part of our Athena Swan agenda, has been induction. But what it was like to onboard during COVID, we hired people during the lockdown. And it was like, you know, great, you know, these are the meetings, we're online. and everything was so busy that that when they did have to come in to teach, they sort of were coming into empty corridors of staff, you know, and trying to find the classroom or all the. It was a really complicated time.
Not a good experience.
Not a good way to start. So we're trying to now look back retrospectively and figure that by working with these colleagues to figure out how can we do this better, you know.
That's a huge challenge. Like I was talking to someone now, it wasn't in this university, but that started their job in university during the pandemic, and like that, they were saying that they might have met in person maybe 3 or 4 people still. You know, and you really would forget about, like, if you're in a position where you were there before the pandemic, you'd forget about that.
You would.
You know, you think about the challenges of everyone working from home and things, but the people that were employed during it, it's been a different.
But what's really important going forward now is thinking about how people do come with hybrid working, how people do come in and do connect and do get known, because there is a possible gender dimension to that in terms of being, you know, at home, like women being at home more, caring more for kids or doing those pieces and not being on the campus or on the job, wherever they're working as much. But, you know, your promotion isn't just about the work that you do. It's about how you're known and how people talk about you and how people experience you.
Exactly.
And that's in the conversations, in those meetings that you're in and out of all of the time.
So we have to keep an eye on that. Your image, your performance, and as we say, your exposure. And if people don't know you, or that you don't come to, like, often in the surveys that we've done and the research is that the same people get asked to do the same same things all the time, the same opportunities, and you can have indirect discrimination there because a manager could say, well, they've young children and I didn't think she'd be available to go, and you're going, well, you need to ask,
like,
you can't make that decision for them because they're losing out on an opportunity they might have liked to have. So you need to make sure you don't do anything in an indirect way, but also that socialization piece, that's that, as we go back to again, the sense of belonging to an organization that you are very much part of. If you continue to work from home, you won't have that. And I think part of being, but this was what I always loved about coming to UL and driving and was seeing all the young people. They keep you young, that energy, watching them out in the freezing cold in shorts and thinking, to be young again and not feel cold. You know, it's just that energy you get from young people. They keep us that are getting older much, much brighter, connected, wanting to continue to do things. They definitely keep us younger. And you miss that so much. You know, you just get into yourself if you're just working away. It's not the same experience.
So, Mary, we ask people a few questions as we wrap up. So one of the things that we might ask you is, if, as you look back on your career journey and your leadership roles and all of that, is there anything you would do differently?
I think I'd do a lot differently.
All right, okay.
I'm always very jealous of people say, no, I wouldn't do anything differently in my life. And I'm thinking, yeah, I'd do lots differently, actually. Yeah, I think I would. First and foremost, I would have gone as a full-time young person to college, definitely. And I would have travelled more. I'm absolutely delighted that my children are travelling the world. My son, when I was giving out to him, he's in Australia for 14 years. He said, but you're the one that said, do your degree and the world's your oyster. And I said, yeah, I kind of didn't mean you go and you don't come back.
14 years is a stretch.
But he is now moving home. The girls are in Australia experiencing the world and having amazing lives and created lovely lives for themselves. For me, I kind of nearly lived through them in doing the world thing and being able to visit them. I think what I really would have wished I had was more courage when I saw things or felt things were wrong in standing up. And that's why I try and say to people, I didn't do this and I paid a price. So I'm just trying to give other people the courage to, when things aren't right, you know, have the courage to nicely, respectfully say, can we talk about this? I probably would be somebody that just lets things go. So I would have done that differently. In my career and personal life, I suppose I had very challenging young life, in getting married very young, getting separated very young, bringing my children up very young. The change of that would be, I shouldn't have got married so young. I should have listened to my heart. And I always say that to the kids, listen to your gut and listen to your heart, because I kind of knew it wouldn't really work. My regret is that the children would have felt they suffered as a result, but they absolutely say they haven't.
Yeah.
You don't want that. You know, you don't want that. In back in my day, it was really difficult because there was no divorce.
Yeah.
I had to go to a church annulment, which I definitely wouldn't do again.
Okay.
So I have loads of I wouldn't do. Yeah, but that was to keep everybody happy.
Yeah.
I suppose I was definitely a people pleaser. I don't think that's a good trait.
No.
So I could write a book on the things.
Yeah, well, maybe
I
you
do.
Should. Yeah, like, maybe you should.
I would do differently. Yeah. What I wouldn't change is having my wonderful children and having a second chance at life. And I think I'm able to give that to others that, you know, might seem awful now, but there is light at the tunnel.
Yeah.
And if you make the hard decision that things are not right, and is it, you have the courage to get out of it and then start a new life,
wow,
things start to take off. And that's where you get the courage to go on. And where somebody, you might have listened to somebody keeping you down, you went on and do your qualifications, get qualified, yeah, give your children everything you can possibly give them, and have a good life and be happy. And right now, that's the result,
yeah,
that I'm
brilliant.
Happy. But life has thrown a lot of curveballs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think what's amazing about you, Mary, is that you are so reflective. And you've dedicated your career to making it different for other people. That's a huge gift to give to the world. And as one of the women who've benefited from your work here in this university and been successful because of it, it is a tremendous gift.
Yeah,
so I love that. And I value that very highly in you, I must say. Many of us do. So we don't always say that to each other here, but the value of it is huge. So to give that is huge.
I hope I've done some good, because I haven't long more to stay. So
well, I think for as long as is humanly possible would be what we would want. If you had some advice to anybody starting out, what would you say?
I think the advice is kind of what I said, is take opportunities. You know, you might think it's not the right time, but, you know, it's never the right time. Life always gets in the way.
Yeah, that's true.
So
very true.
Take the opportunities you're given, even though you think, oh, I couldn't possibly do that. You know, you'll get the courage from somewhere. You know, you're always glad when you just push yourself a little.
Yeah.
It's worth it. And I think have faith in your own ability. I think that's, you know, we all have this unbelievable ability inside ourselves that we don't really realize we have. And I think really trust that you have that ability to do things.
Mm-hmm.
And I always say, surround yourself with good friends. You don't need a lot of friends. My friends are deeply important to me, family and friends. And I have a few friends that are always there. And I think, and I'm there for them. And I think, you know, don't let your friends go. Do not just live. I think the Australian way of living is they work to live, not live to work. And I think really try and get the balance right.
Mm-hmm.
I have a very good friend who you know well, Professor Christine Cross, who she gets her balance right.
She's amazing.
I sign off. How do you manage to do it? It's really important to have a life, that work shouldn't take up your life, because life passes you by fairly quickly. And I think it's really important to try and get balance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Dr. Mary Connolly, I think you're a legend. I'm just going to say that to you, but you've probably picked that up. But I really think you should write a book about your insights. I think you have a lot to offer that you've given to us, but there's a wider world that needs to hear your...
No. You're after forgetting one question now.
Okay. There. What was the question?
A leader that inspires you.
Oh my goodness, really, the most important question. Yes, exactly.
A leader that inspires you, and why?
There are so good. I missed the question.
Yeah. I was trying to think about that. There's lots, and I was thinking, if I have to pick one, well, I kind of have two. Well, one academic and
two.
One. So Mary McAleese, I've always really admired her, and I particularly have admired her in challenging the church
Absolutely.
And state. And I think, what a brave woman. She showed her own vulnerability, and that's where I suppose the vulnerability in being able to talk about the challenges her son had as a gay person and how the church were treating her loved one, and how she just took them on and does so in such, she's such a, an amazing mind and academic, and fearless. I think she's fearless. And when you, I met her one time, she opened the walled gardens for us in Napogue one time, and she was so much fun.
Oh.
And she was dancing sets. And so she could be this wonderful, warm, normal person, and yet this fearless leader. Yeah. So for me, she, I really, really admire her. And I think she's a lovely person. So you don't have to be ruthless. I also, I absolutely adore Brené Brown.
We're too.
I listen to her all the time. And I just think sometimes I relate to her journey where she started off and had to come and keep going and keep going and was later to education. I just think, just you can listen to her. She's such down to earth and gives you really nice words of wisdom and not afraid to be authentic.
Yeah, I think she's incredible.
Yeah,
we're huge fans.
Are you?
Yeah.
I always listen to her as well. Yeah, she's brilliant. She's so personable.
She is, isn't she? Yeah. Normal and down to earth and not forceful in what she's saying. Mm. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the leadership's podcastical, you know.
Yeah.
You know, they're just selling and then you think, what's behind it?
Yeah.
But she's lived life.
Yeah, and she, what I always enjoy about her is how honest she is, and it's quite like your, you know, your response there to if you would do anything differently, you know, like that's such an honest response, and I always find that listening to her as well.
Yeah,
you know,
very much.
Like challenges the thinking, or you know, comes up with a new idea or a way of looking at things. You know, you can hear her like being reflective and being like, or at times that, oh, I'm definitely guilty of that, or And I think it's that's there's so much value in it because you know she's so genuine.
And I love, like, she has years of thinking behind what she's doing. You know, she's so much research done and fitted so much in, but and she's able to just cut through all of the academicizing of it and really translate it into a way that anyone can take
she's
from.
She's very relatable.
Yeah.
It's not all academic. You know, she is very relatable, isn't she? I think people, that's why people connect, and I think women particularly connect with her, because she has that vulnerability of being a woman.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter what anyone says, we're different.
Yeah,
men and women are different.
Yeah,
and now we have our wider trans community to think of as well, and we need to be inclusive.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, keep doing the amazing work, Mari.